This is the Sunshine Economy. Today, we're in Cuba. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. We're in Mariel, about 30 miles southwest of Havana. 36 years ago, next month, this was the port where thousands of Cubans left the island. The mass exodus lasted for 6 months, bringing 125,000 Cubans to South Florida. Today, this is the place the Cuban government hopes is the entry point of billions of dollars of foreign trade and investment. It was created in 2013 and represents Cuba's most concerted effort to play a role in global trade. In return, it hopes to generate $2.5 billion a year of foreign investment into Cuba. Now, those are the economics. Saul Barenthal and Horace Clemens are two of the people hoping to build their company here. They're both retired American technology entrepreneurs. Clemens is from Alabama. Barenthal was born here in Cuba. They secured the first American okay to build a factory in Cuba since the trade embargo was put in place 54 years ago. They're negotiating right now with the Cuban government to build a factory within the Special Development Zone, or ZED, here in Mariel. They say that factory will be able to build a tractor every 20 minutes with parts made in the USA, at least initially. We caught up with the two at an agricultural fair in Havana late last week, where they met with government authorities and Cuban farmers.
The best message we got was after spending about an hour with the farmer and answering all his questions and looking at what he believed we needed to change. As he was leaving, he stopped and came back and said, if you can produce enough tractors within 2 years, every Cuban farmer will have one.
That's the Alabaman Horace Clemens. They want to build 16,000 tractors a year, but they won't be able to do it right away. Of course, all of this rests on getting a deal with Cuba to put their factory in this special development zone, a factory Saul Barenthal is proud to say will be 100% American-owned.
It is the only area in Cuba in which you do not need to have government participation on it.
This is a significant point. This is not a joint venture that you're doing with the Cuban government, nor any Cuban ownership in this factory, its merchandise, the capital goods, the investment that you're making here in Cuba.
Correct. Not only that, but it is a factory that's going to be producing a tractor that is specifically built for the private sector of Cuba. We are delivering a product to end users that are self-employed, either owners of small farms or cooperatives that are that own the land that they work. The misconception of American businesses providing revenues to the government does not exist in our model. We are selling directly to end users. We are allowed to use government existing facilities for distribution, but the end user is always going to be a private sector individual.
His factory, if and when it's built, will be owned by Americans, but it will be built on land leased from the Cuban government. While the government is using Mariel's special designation and economic rules to attract business like the tractor factory, it's also hopeful the billion-dollar investment it has made in building the port's infrastructure will give it an advantage in the competition for global trade. It's an investment Barenthal also hopes to use.
Mariel is not only a zone for us to be able to be 100%, but Mariel's is also a port with tremendous amount of technology and facilities to bring and ship. So our business model contains the ability to export to other countries.
That may sound a little odd to Americans exporting from Cuba, considering the American trade embargo banning trade with the island. But beyond any embargo, Barenthal thinks if he can build his tractor factory here in Cuba, he'll have an advantage trading with the rest of Latin America.
The ability to export from Cuba from a facilities point of view is obvious. What it may not be obvious is that people should realize that Cuba has treaties with very advantageous terms with every other country in Latin America.
Advantageous in terms of low tariffs?
Correct. So a tractor built in Cuba, hecho in Cuba, would be able to be placed in a Latin American country much cheaper than if we have that same tractor built in the United States and then shipped to that country.
The focus of all this economic ambition is a one-seat red steel frame tractor with a gas or diesel engine. It can plow only one row at a time. This is not for the modern factory farm.
Some people say it looks like a spider. Some people say it looks like a go-kart.
Horace Clemens walked me around the display model they had at the agriculture fair in Havana.
It's really very simple. We have the key there before you turn the tractor on. And after you turn it on, the throttle is simple, so there are very little control levers. So there is no transmission per se, just hydrostatic transaxles. So the pedal, you push forward to go forward, you push down on the back to go backwards, and that's all it is to it. There's a forward and the backward.
But there's plenty making this American-owned factory a reality here in Mariel. For Barenthal, it's returning to his homeland. He left Cuba in 1960 when he was 16. Now he wants to bring his factory here, investing $5 million with his partner Clemens, hoping to assemble tractors in Cuba in about a year.
It's really very simple. It always is, as a matter of fact. All you got to do is understand.
He points to the 2011 economic reforms put in place by Cuba, designed to attract foreign investment. Laws, he says, serve as the guidelines for any company, American or otherwise, wanting to invest here.
In my mind, any project that is brought for Cuba for consideration has to have three elements. It has to have an economic justification, it has to have a social justification, and it has to have a cultural justification. It's not hard when you understand those principles.
What are the social and cultural justifications of this red tractor we're sitting next to?
From a social point of view, you need to realize that Cuba imports 70% of what it eats. The government is committed to provide food for the people of Cuba. The government has always been trying to improve productivity of agricultural goods. This tractor, in the hands of the people who can be motivated, because this is the private sector, by increasing their production, provides for the social welfare of the government being able to have enough food for their social commitment to the country of feeding the people, as well as provides the ability for the private sector to make a profit.
And the cultural justification for this tractor?
The cultural justification is very simple. Look at the name of our tractor. The name of our tractor is Ogun.
Ogun is the Santeria god of metal and power. He hopes the name indicates the cultural understanding his company brings with it to Cuba. His partner, Horace Clemens, whose grandfather was a farmer in Alabama, adds another goal, perhaps more personal.
It will allow the farm family to stay together and provide livelihood and work and meaning to their life without the kids all having to move off somewhere else because there's no opportunity on the farm.
WLRN's Tim Padgett is with me here in Mariel. Tim, these tractors that Saul and Horace want to build, $8,000 to $10,000 list price, they say farmers will be able to afford them. How?
Well, it is a good chunk of money when you consider that in Cuba, most workers make only about $20 a month. But I think Saul and Horace are betting on maybe three things. One, that these Cuban farmers will be able to get remittances from relatives in the United States, particularly from in South Florida. Number two, that the Cuban government will help subsidize a lot of this cost. And number three, something that I think we forget, in the past decade or so, farmers in Cuba have been permitted to sell a lot more of their surplus crops and keep those revenues. And I think a lot of them have been saving enough to help pay for it.
We are now on a four-lane interstate highway. You can hear the trucks going by. We're on a bridge that's over a double-track railway. All of this is new within the past couple of years leading into and out of this special development zone at the Port of Mariel. What does the possibility of all of this, including the tractor factory, represent in terms of the process of economic engagement, not only between the U.S. and Cuba, but also Cuba and the rest of the world?
Well, when I stand here, Tom, two things hit me in the face. One is that Cuba does want to become part of the global economy. You look at all this spanking new infrastructure, this more than billion-dollar project that's been taking place here the past few years, a new rail line right under us, cranes out in the distance there that remind me a lot of the new cranes at the Port Miami. The problem being, however, the question is, to what extent is the Cuban government ready to change and open up sufficiently to make full use of this new infrastructure?
It's been 15 months now since President Obama began this normalization policy leading up to the visit this week by the president in Havana. There's been a lot of criticism, of course, that the Americans have been changing economic policies without the Cubans changing human rights policies. are Americans and even Cuban Americans looking for opportunities here? Are they ignoring something?
There are some things that I think American and foreign companies are waiting to see on the part of the Cubans before they get full in on this project. Things, for example, like employment policy. American companies and foreign companies want to be able to hire their own workers and pay them what they feel they're worth. Right now, Cuban policy is that it's the Cuban government that does the hiring and sets salaries, for example. And for a lot of Cuban workers, that salary is not much of an incentive. But perhaps even more important, foreign companies are waiting to see, for example, in the special development zone here, to what extent will they have to enter into joint ventures with state-run Cuban companies? Will they be able to negotiate, for example, what Saul and Horace have said they've been able to negotiate in terms of maintaining 100% American ownership of their enterprise? These are the questions that I think American and foreign companies, you know, have. A lot of them are holding back. Well, and plus the other big question being, will the U.S. lift the trade embargo?
To that point, this is the place, Port of Mariel, the special development zone where we're at. It's not on the official schedule for President Obama. Is he or even his hosts missing an opportunity to engage here in Mariel?
I don't think so, because Obama himself, like any U.S. official or executive, has the same questions. And so I think what he's focusing on is just staying back in Havana and promoting what he does know is happening in the Cuban economy, which is small entrepreneurs burgeoning in number in Cuba. And he wants to promote those small businesses, those small enterprises, as a way of helping Cubans become more independent of the government. This larger project, this more large scale type of investment has a lot of questions still behind it. And I think Obama would rather just sort of stay in Havana with what he knows is working at this point, rather than come out here and showcase something that is still very nascent.
We will go back to Havana ourselves as the sunshine economy in Cuba continues. We go to the Miramar district of Havana, where a cooperative of accountants is pushing the boundaries of private enterprise in Cuba.
Es decir, el Estado hace como que te paga y yo hago como que trabajo.
In English, is the government pretend to pay us and we pretend to work for the government.
We are back on the Sunshine Economy in Cuba. I'm Tom Hudson in Havana. Thanks for listening. History and diplomacy are on display with just about every move made by President Obama on his trip here in Havana, including his meeting with the group of Cuban entrepreneurs. These are the early economic trailblazers the White House is betting are the beneficiaries of its efforts to remove travel, trade, and financial restrictions. But some of those entrepreneurs have been pioneering their own paths through Cuban economic reforms, pushing the boundaries of those changes. Slide open the pocket doors of a front salon of a mansion on Quinta Avenida, Fifth Avenue, in the Miramar district, and you find a scene that's not out of place among startup businesses in the United States. Around a big dining room table is a group of people huddled over laptops with open spreadsheets and documents. This is a private, well, not a company. After all, this is Cuba. It's a non-farm cooperative called Cenius.
The people don't take salary anymore.
Luis Alberto Dueñas is the president of the cooperative.
Because they are partner of the cooperative. But from the profit point of view, it's twice, three times, and even sometimes more than five times what they earned maybe 3 years ago.
Non-farm cooperatives began in 2013. It was the first time since 1968 the Cuban government allowed private cooperatives outside of the agriculture industry. Most of that first batch of these were still related to agriculture. They were produce markets. What Dueñas and his partner are doing is way beyond fruit and vegetable stands.
We are dedicated to accounting and economical service. Taxes, profitables. And the beginning was dedicated to the non-state sector.
Cenius is about what we would call business services, bookkeeping and inventory, but also financial planning and business consulting. They were working with other cooperatives initially, but a year after starting, the main client for Cenius has turned out to be
the state enterprise, who demand our service.
This is a much different business relationship in Cuba, a private cooperative hired by the Cuban government.
The government recognized that for 400, 500 pesos, sometimes it's not quite easy to find motivated accountant people. Okay. For 500 pesos, which is $20, $30. So sometimes the photo of Cuban enterprise is not so good from the accountant point of view because they are not so efficient to afford a good salary for the people, okay? That is why they prefer to hire us. And we are talking about the same economists, the same accountant that previously used to work for the state sector.
It's a changing relationship, according to Duenas' co-founder, Alfonso Larrea. A big change from the way workers thought of their jobs when they worked for the government.
Es decir, el Estado hace como que te paga y yo hago como que trabajo.
In English, is the government pretend to pay us and we pretend to work for the government.
Senius has turned that on its head. In January last year, the cooperative did 100,000 Cuban pesos in revenue. In December, 2 million. That kind of hockey stick growth is attracting more accountants and other professionals to the cooperative. It had 150 partners at the end of last year. 2 months later, 175. And it expects to have more than 200 well before the end of this year.
It's very natural demand for now. It's not a big marketing strategy what we have been doing so far, because the demand is higher, very high. We are the only non-farm cooperatives doing this service nowadays.
I think that here in Cuba, and our business mainly, we are pushing boundaries all the time.
That's Ernesto Victorero. He's 24 and just graduated college with an economics degree. He is a partner in Senius, in sales. Yes, he works in sales in Cuba.
We are trying to expand our business and go one step ahead of everyone else.
Victorero recognizes what the Cuban government has recognized and the Obama administration hopes to accelerate. The future of Cuba's economy rests on carving out increasing space for private enterprise.
More people are going to join this movement that we are head right now. So, and I think that the government has understand this, and also is looking forward it to happen. Of course, in a controlled and taking small steps at the time. So, but of course, the changes are happening, and also we are. I think that they won't be a step back in that way.
Ernesto Victorero, a partner in the private cooperative Senius, part of a new generation of Cubans working in a new economic experiment in Cuba. Still to come, when the sunshine economy in Cuba continues, the American banker working to open up the country.
Hopefully down the road, I won't be considered the only American banker. I'll just be maybe the first American banker instead.
This is the Sunshine Economy in Cuba. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. I'm in Havana. President Obama arrived here late yesterday during an afternoon shower. He went straight to Old Havana for a walking tour. The area is the historic city center with its narrow streets, plazas, and European architecture. It has become a tourist mecca to experience the city within its old defensive walls. Beyond the charm, though, a visitor sees the missing windows, rusted iron gates, and crumbling buildings, decaying from years of exposure, indifference, and neglect. The president started his historic trip in one of the most historic places in Cuba as he tries to forge a new future for Cuban-American relations. That effort has been concentrated on finance. A week before his speech here in Cuba, the administration released its latest effort to loosen American financial regulations with the island. Among the changes, allowing U.S. banks to open accounts for Cubans here who are doing business that is allowed under the embargo and the restrictions that still remain. David Selesky was the first American banker in Cuba. Selesky is the CEO of Stonegate Bank, based in Pompano Beach. Last year, it became the first bank to open accounts for Cuban diplomats in the United States, the first U.S. bank to use the easier restrictions to set up a relationship with a Cuban bank, and the first to offer customers a debit card that works in Cuba.
Selesky is here this week in Havana. WLRN's Tim Padgett and I caught up with him at a beach on the edge of the city.
The original plan was just to really bank American companies that were doing business in Cuba and try to support their efforts, bridge the cultural gap, facilitate their ability to do business in Cuba. But now with the new regs that came out on Tuesday, we have the opportunity to support Cuban entrepreneurs. Before, it was very difficult for a Cuban entrepreneur to open a bank account in the U.S. And buy materials to take back to Cuba. It was a big problem getting money back and forth and everything, and that really opened up a lot of doors. I mean, I don't view that as being a real profit center for us, but I view it as more of a duty to try to help these people succeed in what they're doing.
Is any of the Cuban engagement thus far for Stonegate and its shareholders a profit center?
No, not yet. I mean, I think that, one of the things is, and this is a very positive thing, is, we will develop a product or develop a process, and then an executive order will come out and it'll kind of change everything that we've done. We got to start over again. But every time those executive orders come out, they're a positive event for Cuba and its people. So we're okay with that. But, I think until things settle down, I do think ultimately it will be profitable for us. But I think until things settle down, it's very hard. It's like hitting a moving target to some degree.
That target has been moving with the financial regulations that have been loosened up from the United States. What does that timeline look like? What kind of return on investment are you anticipating from Cuba?
Well, I think we're probably at least another 6 to 9 months until we start seeing that, because there's just hundreds of U.S. companies have inquired about doing business in Cuba.
Before you start seeing net positive profits.
I mean, they've got to get their approvals and they've got to get up and running and before, really anything can happen. And, we're only a year into this process. So, but they're, I think Starwood signed a deal yesterday.
The resort and hotel company.
Yeah. I mean, that's another step. And so, all these companies got to get up and running. The airlines are all approved, but they're not running yet. So, it just, like everything, it just takes time. It's been such a long gap between the two countries doing anything together. It's not as quick as opening up an air service or something in the UK or Bermuda or something like that. It just takes more time to get everything, their ducks in a row.
Stonegate's banking business is based in Broward County. It is concentrated in South Florida. This is an emotional issue, obviously, for South Florida. Has Stonegate's entrees into Cuba costed any business in Florida?
We lost a few clients initially, but now most people, the comments, even the people that are, maybe don't agree with the policy, I think their philosophy is, well, if Stonegate wasn't doing it, somebody else would be doing it. They realize the train.
Do you believe that?
Yeah. I think they've the train's left the station. I think they realize it. And most people, I think, are coming around to the policy of, look, things are far enough along now. Look, we may not like it, but if we oppose it or if we try to sabotage it, then, it's detrimental to the Cuban people. And I think on the whole, people are, at worst complacent for the most part if they were dead set against it. The attitudes are changing pretty dramatically.
Finance is a foreign language for a number of people outside of the world of high finance, but it has been key in the renormalization process that has been undertaken by the Obama administration in the past 15 months. How much further do you think the administration can go without Congress acting on the embargo?
Well, I think the difficulty now is simply that, his term is coming to an end. I don't think it's an issue. I think there's more things that could be done, but I think it's more of an issue of, typically a president in the very last stages of his presidency doesn't typically do a lot. So I don't expect that we'll see that much more coming out of the White House in terms of regs. But, there's a lot of things with the existing regs that are very broad, and there's a lot of interpretation that needs to go with that. And that's probably where you're going to see the most movement, is just interpretation of existing regs which will help speed things up even more.
Give me an example of some of the regulations that have changed that you're still kind of finding your way through.
Well, a lot of the stuff regs on a Tuesday are very much open to interpretation. I mean, once again, you get to the Cuban entrepreneurs, can a Cuban entrepreneur open up a business in a Cuban business name, a corporation in the U.S.? We don't know the answer to that. I think the movement of money in terms of them being allowed to use the dollar globally, I mean, there's still some questions as to how that's going to function. So there's still some things up in the air that need to be worked through. But, you know, look, I mean, it's very hard. I think the idea is the right way the White House has done it in terms of writing these things very broadly and then defining them as time goes by, you know, and seeing what it is. Because you can't cover, it'd be a 500-page document. You know, you can't cover every contingency that's going to happen. So I think in that way they can kind of control to make sure that they're not breaking the embargo in Helms-Burton.
But David, we've been speaking with entrepreneurs here who have shown us that they found very ingenious ways to skirt the embargo. Not just the entrepreneurs here, but businesses up in the United States. We've spoken with some who say that they're regularly buying materials from companies in the United States, like places like Hialeah, and using them here to further their businesses. At this point, what can a bank like Stonegate do to help Cuban entrepreneurs move even further in terms of, let's face it, importing what they need from the United States, which is really technically a violation of the embargo?
I think, you know, you got to look at, yes, that's been going on for a long time. It's been going on for years and years and years. But now it's like, now it can be legal. You know, now it can be upfront and stick with within the parameters of the law. So now, you know, a Cuban business could incorporate in the U.S., could open an account, could buy supplies, could receive payments for goods they sell in the U.S. And be able to transfer that money back to Cuba. Before it was all done, you know, basically putting the money in your backpack and, you know, and shipping the materials through Panama and third countries and things like that. So I think it brings it out in the open. Yes, there was a lot of that, but I think it's important that now it's a legal process.
Stonegate is banking Cuban diplomats in the United States. Has a Cuban national in Havana been able to open up a bank account in Pompano Beach?
A Cuban national, yes, we've opened a few. We opened a few prior to these new regs on Tuesday. But that was mostly like academians that were exchange professors, doctors who were coming to conferences regularly in Miami. But there was a lot of restrictions with those accounts, so we didn't open it up. Now with the new regs, obviously we can be much more proactive in opening these accounts because we don't have to do as much monitoring and there's not as many issues. I mean, and that was something I was pushing in terms of, you know, if you really want to support these entrepreneurs and the Cuban nationals, you got to allow them to do banking in the U.S. And that was something that it was very difficult for them up until last Tuesday.
As a corporate pioneer in the U.S. banking industry engaging in Cuba, what would you like to hear from the president during this trip?
I look at a year ago where we were and I look at where we are today, it is night and day. You know, to the outsider who maybe is not involved day to day, I mean, they maybe not see that. So hopefully he'll focus very much on the positive changes that have taken place. It's going to result in a lot of good things down here. You know, the politics, forget the politics, it's just the look of hope, the excitement of people in Cuba that things are changing and that they can have economic freedom. 2 or 3 weeks ago, I came back down here, and it was interesting. Everybody you talked to, you mentioned the word Obama and his visit, and their face would light up. And it was bigger than the Pope. I mean, you know, to them, this is the most powerful man in the world is coming to Cuba.
Have you opened up any new accounts since the new regulations were announced on Tuesday of Cuban entrepreneurs here on the island?
I think it's too quick. I mean, it just came out Tuesday. Everyone's trying to interpret it and all that type of stuff. And frankly, ever since Obama announced this trip, everything's kind of gone to a standstill on both sides in terms of just supporting the president's trip. I think once he leaves, maybe the Rolling Stones get out of here, then maybe we'll see a little bit more movement on that end.
Back to business as normal then, as normal is here in Cuba.
Yeah, I'm not so sure there's such a thing as normal.
David Selesky, the CEO at Stonegate Bank from Pompano Beach. He is among the American business leaders here in Cuba this week during the president's visit. Still to come as the sunshine economy in Cuba continues, economics and reconciliation.
The Cuban Americans in South Florida, you know, most of us have matured because of age and because we recognize that, look, if a dog bites you when you're a kid or even rips your leg off, doesn't mean that you don't have a dog for the rest of your life. I actually was bitten by a dog and have five of them today.
This is the Sunshine Economy in Cuba. I'm Tom Hudson. We're in Havana today, South Florida, just 90 miles north. But the gulf between Cuba and the Cuban-American community can be much wider than just points on a map. The toll of decades of family separation, economic isolation, and political persecution makes President Obama's trip here difficult to tolerate for some. When Mike Fernandez talks about U.S.-Cuban relations, he sounds like the billionaire healthcare entrepreneur he is.
Can you show me the facts? Can you show me the data that points as to how the embargo has delivered a deliverable?
Last week, Fernandez was at a White House meeting with President Obama and 15 other Cuban-American leaders. They spoke with the president as he prepared for his trip here this week. We spoke with Fernandez in his hotel room near the National Capitol Building in Havana, just two blocks from the Gran Teatro, where President Obama will deliver his speech Tuesday morning.
The conversation have been, he wanted to listen to what we had to say, what we would suggest for him to touch on as important points in his speech. Very interesting that he actually took notes. He took a pencil out of his pocket. He not only took notes, but he also interacted with each of the individuals. Every one of the 16 had something to say. And he had exchange of words with each one of the 16th, either inquiring in more depth as to what they were suggesting or challenging the points that we were making. So it was a very active meeting. My understanding, it was supposed to take about an hour. We were there over 90 minutes. It was a very, very pleasant exchange to see his sincerity on this issue.
What did that leave you with in terms of anticipation for his message on Tuesday to the Cuban people, but also, as the White House has been clear, the speech on Tuesday to Cuban Americans, especially those in South Florida?
The Cuban Americans in South Florida, you know, most of us have matured because of age and because we recognize that, look, if a dog bites you when you're a kid or even rips your leg off, doesn't mean that you don't have a dog for the rest of your life. I actually was bitten by a dog and have five of them today. Some people have the ability to forgive. I'm not saying forget, I'm saying forgive. Because it's something that we as human beings can do without permission from the other side. This is not about the perpetrator. This is about you and having control that nobody can manipulate you. And I think the Cuban government has been a great puppet master in manipulating reactions in Miami. And they have played us like a fiddle. We were dancing to their fiddle most of the time. I think the president's message to the Cuban Americans in Miami or in the United States is it's been long enough. It has been long enough following a strategy that has not produced one single result. And it is time to try something else. Should we not stop trying to hurt two people versus helping 11 million people? It's time for a change. And sometimes you cannot tell someone who you're trying to make them change, I want to dethrone you. I want a regime change. So I expect that he's going to have a very consolatory, reconciliatory conversation or speech, at the same time recognizing that changes in Cuba is going to force changes within Cuba, and the government would have to react to it. But Cuba is a sovereign country, the same way as the Philippines is a sovereign country. Our ability to change Cuba is very limited as an outsider, that's the reality that we all have to face. In Cuba, they feel that the president has the authority to lift the embargo. He doesn't. He can modify it, he can change it, but not lift it. In Miami, in Cuban American population, they feel that the president should clamp down and choke the Cuban government even more. But they fail to realize that the person that is getting hurt the most, it's not the Cuban leadership. It is the mom and the dad and the grandmother who are lacking for many of the basic goods.
There's clearly been a significant focus and effort here in Havana acknowledging the global focus a presidential trip will bring after two papal visits, after the visit by the Secretary of State of the United States for the first time in a half century. Do you have concerns that with the Cuban government's behavior under a microscope with the global media here this week, that it may revert to past behaviors in 2 weeks, 2 months, a year's time?
You know, I think all of us sometimes revert to positions that we later regret. But it's the ability to pull yourself back and get yourself in the right path. I do have a concern that in 2-3 months down the road, when the flags have faded and the banners have torn down and the streets go back to being the way they were, and people do not see a change in their ability to buy food at an affordable price, that there would be voice opposition, and that will lead then to actions by the state, which are going to be punitive and going to be in some cases abusive. So that is a concern. But we have to understand that the Cuba issue took 57 years to get us here. It is not going to be 3 weeks after the president leaves or 3 months for things to be normalized, but things are better. Look, a few years ago, there was no private sector in Cuba. Today, there's 500,000 plus private businesses, and those private businesses employ 40% of the Cuban workforce.
A number of the reasons why is because of the 2011 reforms that the Cuban government made, not necessarily because of actions that any U.S. administration made.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can see where the Cuban government is recognizing that they cannot, as a government, employ 100% of the workforce in Cuba. And what we are doing is actually working with them in trying to minimize the hit to them and create a workforce that is actually earning more. And it has the benefit that comes with creating something yourself, build your self-esteem, build a better life for yourself. So it is good for the country.
How should Cuban Americans specifically, but also Americans, judge the actions that the Obama administration has taken in several years' time? What are the metrics? You're a businessman. You've been a great success by measuring outcomes. How should the American people measure the outcome of this process of normalization that began 15 months ago?
Well, I happen to be a Republican. And by the way, half of the people in the White House cabinet table earlier this week were also Republicans. And I think most of us have been critical of a lot of the steps taken by the administration.
Not specific to Cuba, though.
Non-specific to Cuba. Absolutely, non-specific. Look, there are two things that I clearly support the president on. That is the hunting down of Osama bin Laden and the opening of the embassies in both Cuba and Washington, D.C. With regards to that, I give him an A+. It is a neighbor that is 90 miles from us. Look, we're a country that promotes free enterprise, free markets in every nation that we touch, except one, Cuba. My daughter, who is a law student, can go to Iraq. She can go to North Korea. And all she has to do is read a disclaimer from the State Department that is dangerous, but she can fly there. My daughter cannot fly to Cuba unless she meets certain guidelines and gets permission from the State Department. So I think the reality is it is time for us to adjust, because that issue of travel is not a Cuban issue. It's an American right issue. It's a U.S. citizen issue and a right for us to travel and go wherever we want to go.
But how should Americans, again, and Cuban Americans, especially like yourself, judge this new effort of engagement on the part of the United States? Those that have been critical of it have said the U.S. has been giving up too much. It's getting a bad deal.
This is a great deal for the United States. First of all, I don't think every time somebody poses that question like you just did now, I ask him, what exactly has the United States given up? Nothing. The embargo is still in place. Nothing. Now, what has Cuba given up? For the first time in 56 years, we have a direct contract with Sprint, or a technology company, to provide internet services. For the first time in 56 years, we have 61 hotspots in Havana and been expanded. For the first time in 56 years, we have direct mail services. Now, that doesn't say much. Direct mail doesn't mean much anymore, but that includes emails, that includes video conferencing, that includes many other things. For the first time in 56 years, the number of private sector jobs are growing. They were non-existent 10 years ago, 5 years ago. For the first time in 56 years, there are claims that were filed by U.S. companies and individuals for properties that were seized in Cuba, and those claims are being settled. The only country that Cuba has not settled its claims with, in turn, has been the United States. They have settled every other country
and the claims that came from those countries. So I think if you go through the list, you will find at least 42 items where Cuba has given something up, and I'm not sure what we have given them, except extending a hand and saying, we're going to take a different approach to you.
If memory serves right, you left Cuba when you were 12. You've been returning frequently now in the past several years. Has arriving back in Cuba changed for you? Is it becoming more rote?
So I did not come from Cuba. I left in 1964, and I did not come into the year 2000. And honestly, I had read a bunch of books written by Cuban Americans about how emotional the trip had been. When I landed here, it was non-emotional. There were no tears. I could have been landing in Arkansas. It meant absolutely nothing to me. Now, the more I came back, the more I began to see the beauty of the Cuban people and what they're going through. My life and many of us have enjoyed incredibly good luck and good fortune through sacrifice, but also by landing in the U.S. Look, had we landed in Spain or landed in Venezuela, or you know, we would not have been as lucky as we have been. So I think many of us, or I speak for myself, I am at a point in life in which I like to spend more time helping them improve their lives. I expect nothing in return. It's interesting because one Cuban individual with government said to me that I was very dangerous. And I asked him why. He says, because if you don't want anything, I don't know how to manage you.
Miami healthcare entrepreneur Mike Fernandez speaking with us in Cuba. He says he has no plans to do business himself here. When the sunshine economy in Cuba continues, from Washington to waitressing in Havana, the changing relationship with Cubans.
We want him to feel like a Cuban for one day at least.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy in Cuba. I'm Tom Hudson. I'm in the Badado district of Havana, near the Copelia, the government-run ice cream parlor built by Fidel Castro in 1966. In this colonial city, this is considered the most modern of neighborhoods. The tallest building in Cuba is just a few blocks over, at 39 stories tall. The Hotel Nacional is here, overlooking the Malecón. Mobster Meyer Lansky used to have a piece of the casino there. It's also the neighborhood where Elizabeth Duconje works. She grew up in the countryside watching Disney movies on a VCR. The videos came from her aunts, uncles, and cousins in Tampa. She taught herself English watching Aladdin and The Lion King. Today, she is 26 years old and works at a paladar, slang for a private restaurant. La Moralea. It means the moral, like moral of the story. She says she has a college degree in special education and had been working as an art curator before taking the job at the restaurant 2 months ago.
I didn't have a way to support myself and my family. And I started to work here, and it changes. Now I can help my family. Now I can support myself and have something that I couldn't in the past, being a professional. This was a big change, but it was for the better.
Before she started at the restaurant, she told me she made 30 Cuban pesos a month in a good month, but it was usually about half that. That's about 30 U.S. dollars. Now, with tips, mostly from American tourists, she makes that every week. What does the president's visit to Cuba mean for you and your family and your friends?
Well, right now, we really like Obama. He's like the youngest, the simpático is the word. And we saw the change there. And now, what he has done with the embargo, to lift the embargo and all that, we are grateful. We feel grateful. And we love the guy.
Of course, the president has not lifted the trade embargo with Cuba. In fact, no American president can lift the trade embargo. That would take an act of Congress. But what the president has done, especially easing travel restrictions for Americans wanting to travel to Cuba, it's something Duconje says has had an impact in her life. But she also acknowledges her country's many challenges and hopes the president sees them while he's here.
What would you like the president's visit to Cuba here do to your opportunities?
First of all, I would like the president to see the real Cuba, not the one who they are painting the streets and fixing. We know where he's going to be, you know, traveling because of the streets are better looking and stuff. And I want him to know the real Cuba, where the problems are. I want him to know the people, the real people, not the better citizens of this place. And we want him to know the arts, the cultural heritage of our country, because we don't want to miss that. With all this of the capitalism and stuff, we don't want to miss that. We don't want to miss our origins, our history, and we want him to feel that, so he can feel like a Cuban. We want him to feel like a Cuban for one day, at least.
One of the realities is a past fear to even talk to me. What gives you the confidence to talk to a Miami journalist?
Because, believe it or not, here there's no, we call that libertad de expresión. And here in La Moraleja, we can feel like, because of the American visitors and the way we talked about those things. And right now, I feel like free to say whatever I feel. First of all, because Obama is coming. Second of all, because I'm free no matter what. I feel free no matter what. And I can, personally, in my insides, I feel free. And I can say whatever I want.
Elizabeth Duconhey, she works at a privately run restaurant here in Havana. She may not feel like Cuba is part of something yet, but on the business card for the restaurant where she works is a sign of ambition. In a country with very little reliable internet connections and one that has not had a competitive marketplace for many years, the corner of the card reads, "Agradecemos su comentario en TripAdvisor.com." Thank you for your comments on TripAdvisor.com. Wanda Miles is our technical director in Miami. I'm Tom Hudson in Havana. We will leave you with some music from where President Obama began his trip in Old Havana. Thanks for listening.